This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
My brakes are on fire from trying
Good morning.
To slow down.
I'm Welcome into Tactics. I do apologize for being late today, but I am getting in. I want to say a special thank you before I go anywhere with this today. Thanks to Kevin Elkins for volunteering to fill in for me. He wound up just doing a best of, and that's perfectly all right. So I do appreciate him, for a lack of a better way to say it, covering my butt. I do start today, even though I am coming in under less than favorable conditions. I do have actually fantastic news for those of you who are wanting to hear something uplifting. Now, the subject matter itself is, of course, not uplifting, but there is good news that has come out of it. The Waffle House shooting that took place Sunday, they've got the shooter. This happened late yesterday. They were able to apprehend him. And I got to tell you, the more that we learn about this guy, the stranger it gets, because we've had a little bit of time to look into his background, to look into what is going on. The police were able to apprehend him yesterday, so we're certainly glad that this guy is in custody. Like I said, it is strange because we had the shooter in Parkland who was actually captured, and we also had this shooter who has been captured. This is actually fairly uncommon for mass shooters. Usually what happens with a mass shooter is they either kill themselves immediately after their attack, or if they're a terrorist, which happens quite a bit as well, if they're a terrorist committing a mass shooting, what they wind up doing is they want to kill the maximum amount of people possible. So instead of going into hiding, they just continue to try to kill people until somebody kills them. So they just never stop their attack. It is rare that these past couple of mass shootings have been people that we've actually been able to apprehend. The only other mass shooting that comes to mind where that was the case was Dylan Roof, of course, who shot the Emanuel Church up in, I believe it was South Carolina. Horrible, horrible thing. The guy was a white supremacist, and so not a terrorist. And that was part of the reason that they were able to, that it seems as though he didn't either kill himself or go out in a shootout with police officers. But nonetheless, this shooter, we do have him in custody. He has been captured. But this guy is really odd. And it's really hard to kind of put exactly all of this into context, but it does help explain his behavior. So we already knew that he was trying to sneak into the White House. And by the way, I didn't even notice this until just now, but it is kind of odd because I put WH for White House, which is my abbreviation for White House, but I guess it could also stand for Waffle House, so I got to watch that on this story to not say Waffle House when I mean White House. But he was trying to sneak into the White House. This happened the summer of last year. I believe it was in July 2017. So he's trying to sneak into the White House, goes across a restricted area, is picked up by the Secret Service, quickly captured. And the reason for him trying to get into the White House, according to him, is he said, "I'm a sovereign citizen and I have the right to inspect the grounds." So changing his story here a little bit, initially this guy had said, and we saw from reporting yesterday, that he was desperate and wanted to speak to President Trump. And that was something that he parroted over and over again. And apparently his defense of this action is that "I'm a sovereign citizen and I have the right to inspect the grounds of the White House." Sorry, no you don't. That's not how this works. There's a reason that we have security measures in place around the White House and why you were picked up. Nobody has the right to just walk on to the lawn of the White House. That is a secure area. And we have laws protecting that and we have people protecting that, which is why he was able to be picked up by the Secret Service. And a couple other really odd things. Apparently, during the shooting, when he committed this shooting, he drove there and you couldn't tell because he had on a shirt, but he was completely naked from the waist down. So that's pretty odd that he didn't have any clothes on. He had apparently a shirt on, but was completely naked from the waist down. Really disturbed individual. This gets more odd as it goes. And by the way, if he was naked from the waist down, I got to say the guy who tackled him and stopped the shooting, James Shaw Jr., much braver than even I thought from yesterday that he tackled a guy that was half naked. Nobody wants to tackle a naked guy. So Props to James Shaw Jr. once again, even braver than I originally thought that he was, tackling this crazy gunman. And in May 2016, this guy, his parents had reported him for, quote, delusional behavior. So, not sure exactly what that entailed. It just said delusional behavior according to the reports that I saw. But one thing that we do know about from a separate report is that his parents said that he thought that Taylor Swift was stalking him. I don't know why Taylor Swift, but he apparently thought that the pop star was stalking him and keeping tabs on him. And also, they mentioned that he had suicidal tendencies, had said that he wanted to kill himself. So this guy, clearly mentally unhinged, a danger to himself and other people, as we can clearly see. He apparently also stole a car from a BMW dealership. Now, a master criminal, this guy is not, because he stole the BMW but didn't realize that he was stealing a BMW that had GPS. And they were able to quickly track down the car. With this rap sheet and this behavior, I still honestly have no idea how this guy was still walking around and not in prison somewhere. So he's, at this point, already tried to sneak onto the White House grounds, stolen a car, had his own parents report him to police for delusional behavior, suicidal thoughts, and thinking that Taylor Swift somehow was stalking him. Last year, he showed up at a public pool in a pink women's house coat. So that's a little odd. He also claimed that people were tapping his phone and that they were standing outside of his apartment barking like dogs. Again, not really sure what's going on here. And he did show up to that public pool wearing a pink women's house coat, according to the police report. What happened is he shows up to the pool in this pink house coat and then strips down and swims around in his underwear and exposed himself to the police officers that responded to the call. So this dude seriously has some mental problems. Also, there was a police report back in June of 2017 that he was walking around in a pink dress around his father's business holding a rifle. So, obviously strange behavior. And one thing that I wanted to point out, too, evidently, maybe this person is trans. I mean, he's walking around in a pink woman's house coat. He's walking around the first story at a different time, wearing a pink dress, holding a rifle, brandishing that around. This person may be trans. It sounds almost like a scene out of MASH where Klinger is doing guard duty in one of his dresses. But this guy may be trans, and my question about that is, if he is trans, how is the left going to react to this? Because they obviously hate guns, but they have to defend a trans person no matter what they do, so I don't know how the left is going to fall on that. I guess we'll just have to wait and see. But nonetheless, this guy was clearly off his rocker. Like the Parkland shooter, there were multiple reports of him having delusional behavior that... you know, that by any normal standard, any sane person would look at that and go, okay, that guy has some mental problems. And so because of that, because this guy, his profile kind of matches up with the Parkland shooter, that he had clear signs before the shooting ever took place of being mentally insane, this person, just like the shooter in Parkland, should have been committed to some kind of insane asylum, involuntarily committed. His parents were even calling and talking about this. And so this is something that should have taken place. There should have been some kind of law enforcement follow-up with this. There are probably laws on the books, and this is part of the conversation that we had in the wake of the Parkland shooting, that unfortunately a lot of the laws and policies that we have in place now are not conducive to being able to involuntarily commit someone. It's almost impossible, and because of that, and because there's such a high bar, it's unfortunate, but these people are still walking around a danger to themselves and to other people and could really cause a lot of damage, like we're seeing in this case with the Waffle House shooting. But we're going to talk a little bit more about that on the other side of the break, and it looks like we've got a caller on the line, so we're going to try to take your calls in just a moment. 860-1440 if you want to call in.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Righteousness alone can exalt a nation. Patrick Henry.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440. Those are the numbers if you want to call in and let me know what is on your mind. What are you thinking right now? Speaking of that, let's go ahead and jump to the phones. Let's go to Dennis on line one. Good morning, Dennis.
Good morning, Caleb.
Yes, sir. What's on your mind?
Well, you stated Dylann Roof wasn't a terrorist, correct?
Well, Dylann Roof was not a Muslim terrorist. I should have clarified. He was a domestic terrorist.
Okay, because that's what disturbed me, because you flat out said he wasn't a terrorist, but he was a white supremacist.
I'm sorry. What I meant was, because Muslims, usually what they do when they commit a terrorist attack, when you have a radical Muslim doing that, they try to go out in a blaze of glory with some kind of exchange with police officers. I should have been more clear in my language. Yeah, he was a domestic terrorist, but he's not a Muslim extremist.
Right, because I noticed that most people like you are quick to call a Muslim a terrorist, even sometimes when they're not, but then when it's here on American soil and they attack a certain race of people, they're not called a terrorist, and they always try to find a way to find out how they were crazy, or like you did with the guy from the Waffle House.
Well, you can be crazy and also be a terrorist as well. That's also a possibility, but, you know, when that happens... the definition of terrorism is it has to be some kind of politically charged, politically motivated action. And so in Dylann Roof's case, it absolutely was. He believed in a certain political philosophy that white people are better than black people, so on and so forth. And because of that, he committed that act to make a political statement. Ergo, by definition, Dylann Roof was a domestic terrorist.
Right. And also, you know, like the Cumulus ad for Kevin... it's kind of untrue, because they say with him blunt truth, but Kevin never gives blunt truth. And when people call in to give blunt truth, he rejects it. And just like, you know, you...
Dennis, if you got a problem with Kevin, call in on his show.
No, it's not that. It's just like the advertisement with you. They say you're a minister and a Bible scholar, but I don't see how you cannot call these...
Okay, we're not going to get into a... You know, when you devolve into personal ad hominem attacks that have absolutely nothing to do with what we're talking about, I'm not going to keep you on the air. Anyway, now that we've got that out of the way, I do appreciate, though, and I will say this, because I do appreciate this aspect of his call, I do appreciate him calling me to correct me on something, because I should have elaborated a little bit more that Dylann Roof was not a Muslim terrorist. That's what I actually meant to say. So I do appreciate Dennis calling in about that. I do appreciate him correcting me on that, because, you know, sometimes I make mistakes and I need help with that. But, you know, if you're going to call in to just do nothing but do personal attacks and completely go off the rails and not talk about what we're talking about on the show, I'm not going to keep you on after that. Okay, so let's move on. In the case of the Waffle House shooting, getting back on subject here, authorities did seize his guns. So I don't want to give the impression that nothing at all was done by law enforcement officials. The authorities did seize his guns. According to reporting that we have now, what happened is we had this event happen, and they, after his trying to sneak into the White House, that's when authorities basically deemed this guy a danger to himself and others. They had authorities go to his apartment and confiscate his guns. I'm a little unclear based on the articles that I saw about who actually did that, because typically when there's any kind of gun confiscation taking place, 9 times out of 10, that falls to the purview of the ATF, usually they're the ones that take care of that. However, in this particular case, it appears as though it could have been local officials that were just notified and then turned them over later. But at the father's request, the firearms were turned back over to the father in this particular situation, the father of the person that was involved with this. And then after that took place, apparently, what happened when is that afterward he got those firearms back. He returned those firearms to his son, which is certainly not a good thing, not a good idea, because what was going on with that is that if he got those guns back, it appears as though the AR-15 that he used in the shooting actually was one of the guns that he had previously confiscated and then turned over to the custody of his father, who requested that, and then he got the gun back somehow. Now, granted, I'm hesitant to throw stones when we know so little about the story. If the dad did give the guns back to him knowing that he was mentally disturbed, which obviously he knew that the guns were taken away because that's the whole reason that he was in possession of the guns in the first place. So he knew the authorities believed that he was too much of a danger to have his own firearms. So he knew that, and keep in mind that we saw from a report from CNN that I just mentioned that this person apparently also had his parents, which of course his dad would have known about that as well, call in and report that he had disturbing behavior, that he was delusional. And so it is very clear, if you're looking at the narrative right now, that the dad knew that his son was delusional, that he was capable of doing crazy things, that he was not in his right mind. And because of that, if that is the case, and if the dad voluntarily gave the firearms back to his son, I think that there's a case that you can make that there is some legal liability here. Now, maybe that's not what happened, because I hate to throw people under the bus unless we have all the facts. And in this particular case, it is possible that what happened is the son just went to go visit his dad and then stole the firearms back or got them back some other kind of way. But they do believe these are the same guns that were confiscated from him earlier. And if the dad voluntarily gave the firearms back, or the son went and picked up his firearms and the father knew about it and did nothing or didn't report him to the authorities, then I think that there's a legitimate case that there is some legal liability that could take place here. Again, I don't know that for sure. We'll have to look and see what happens and how this story plays out, but I really do think that that is a strong possibility. And if he was reporting this, now I did want to make mention of something else really quickly, is that with this particular individual, with as disturbed and strange and deranged as this person is, it looks as though that alone was his motivation. Now, ironically, like was brought up in the call with Dennis, you don't necessarily have to be one or the other. You can be a crazy person and be a terrorist, but so far as we know, we're looking into his motives and we're not seeing anything, at least not yet, that would lead us to believe that he was a terrorist, had any kind of political motives for what he was doing, that he had aught with anybody in the Waffle House, that he had a problem with anybody there. This looks to be just a random shooting by a crazy person. But, you know, the jury's still out on that. We will continue to collect data, and if we find out new information, we will certainly let you know right here on Tactics on News Radio 1440. Hour 2 is next.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt, every weekday from 9 to 11, only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
The hero of the Waffle House shooting, James Shaw Jr., he speaks out about his experience. We go there now on Tactics.
Well, when this train ends, I'll try again. I'll leave my home at home.
Welcome back. You're listening to Hour 2 of Tactics on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. Welcome back to the Situation Room this morning. And something really uplifting, I believe, took place with the Waffle House shooting. As horrible as it is, and you always hate to see anything like this happen, any loss of life, especially being murdered in cold blood like this at the hands of this psychopath. But I've got to say, there are some positives that have at least come out of this, and I think that that is something that is a very godlike quality to be able to bring out good and heroism, even in incredibly dark and evil times. And so I do greatly appreciate the young man who saved, according to officials, several lives by acting the way that he did, by being able to take out the shooter. And so here is a statement. This is just a little snippet. He gave about a 15-minute interview, a press conference, and answered some questions after the shooting. This is James Shaw Jr., who was the person who stopped the shooting, and wanted to listen to just a little bit of what he had to say, because I thought that this part especially was significant.
And then he proceeded to come in. And then when he proceeded to come in, I actually went behind this like a push door, a swivel door, and he shot through that door, I'm pretty sure, and I'm pretty sure he grazed my arm. And it was at that time that I kind of made up my mind, because there's no way to lock that door, that if it was going to come down to it, he was going to have to work to kill me. So at the time that he was either reloading or the gun jammed or whatever happened is when I ran through the swivel door. I hit him with the swivel door, and then the gun was kind of jammed up and it was pushed down, so we were scuffling. And I managed to get him with one hand on the gun, and then I grabbed it from him and I threw it over the countertop. And then after that, I was trying to get out the door, and I think he was pretty much in the entranceway, so I just took him out with me, out of the entrance and all the way outside.
Okay, so James Shaw Jr. speaking about what exactly happened to him that early Sunday morning at about 3:30 when the shooting actually took place. So incredible, some of the things that he said. I wanted to bring up at least a couple things. He actually said in this exact same clip that he had no formal training. So no formal training. He, when asked about that, he hasn't. He's not ex-military or anything like that. He's not somebody that went through the police academy. He is just a regular citizen, a regular guy who saw it. It took it upon himself to do the best that he could to stay alive. He had a survivor mentality, as it were. And I think that this is something that we can emulate, something that we all need to have, because you'll notice one of the things that he said in that clip, which I thought was really profound, he's going to have to work to kill me. So this is someone who saw a situation, saw that he was in danger, and said, I am not going to be a victim, and fought back and actually tried to preserve his own life, took the initiative and tried to stop this gunman. And luckily he was able to do so without getting seriously injured. Like I said yesterday, he did burn his hand by grabbing the barrel of the gun. Those things can get pretty hot. And he also was grazed in the elbow. But other than that, this guy's in good shape. You can look at him. He's got an injury to his hand and an injury to his elbow, but that's it. So the fact that this guy was able to make it out of this with just scratches is absolutely remarkable. And with no formal training, was able to take this guy out because he thought, I am a first responder. It is up to me to preserve my own life at this particular situation, because I do think that this has been a problem. Here recently in this country, we've kind of gotten away from this mentality. We think, well, you know, we'll leave it to the experts, we'll leave it to the police officers, we'll leave it to the people that are supposed to do this. And there are times where that is a good thing. I don't want everybody turning into a vigilante or Rambo or anything like that. But when your life is threatened, when your life is in danger, you can't just sit around and hope the cops show up. He said, this guy's going to have to work to kill me. If he takes my life, I'm not going to make it easy for him. And that mentality is what allowed him to save himself and save others. And he actually said, when asked about being a hero, he says, I'm not a hero. It was a completely selfish act. I didn't think about saving anybody else at the moment. I was just trying to stay alive myself. You know, maybe that's the case. But the point is, because he had that survivor mentality, because he thought, it is my responsibility to take responsibility for my own life, for my own self-preservation, because he had that mentality, he was able to save other people in the process, even if he didn't go through that that mental step to get there during the heat of the moment. So I really do commend this guy, and whether he claims to be a hero or not, he certainly is, for being able to do that. He is a first responder, and we need to all think about ourselves as first responders. We need to all think about ourselves as people that, when something happens, when there is danger, that we will be the people that will rise up and do the right thing. because like this guy said, he's not a hero. He said he kind of laughed in the press conference too. He says, I'm not the Terminator. I'm not Superman or anything like that. I wasn't going to let this guy kill me. And that's really all it takes. You don't have to be a superhero. You don't have to be a Green Beret or a Marine or anything like that. Obviously that helps, but regular people can take it upon themselves to do the right thing. And so many of us have been conditioned to helplessness, conditioned to just wait for authorities. One thing I think about, and I know that in the wake of Parkland, we've talked about this quite a bit. When it comes to schools, people are finally starting to think about, okay, maybe the way we're handling school shootings is not a good idea. And whether or not you agree with the idea of arming teachers or not arming teachers, whether or not you agree with student resource officers being there, put that aside for just a second. Clearly what we're doing is not working. And that's something that just about everybody agrees on. And what we do right now currently is that we train kids, and I know that I'm young enough that we went through drills like this for active shooter training, that we're supposed to all get under our desk and hide in a room with the lights off. Or we're supposed to all bunch up in the corner of the room. I think they changed that by the time I was in about 6th or 7th grade. Well, everybody clustering together just makes it easier for the gunman to shoot you. That's the problem with that mentality. And yeah, the door may be locked, but if you can blow a lock off, you will be able to break through a window or something like that. This is not a foolproof plan, and if you have a bunch of kids bunched up together like this, we're basically training people from their youth up to think helplessly, to not fight back against somebody, that the best case scenario, the best thing that you can do to preserve your life in this situation is to cower in a corner. We're literally teaching that to our kids, and that follows up, that goes into adulthood. Luckily, James Shaw Jr. did not subscribe to that theory, and that is probably why he's still alive today. And another thing that I wanted to mention, because I do really like this guy, I want to give him all the accolades that I can. Not only did James Shaw Jr. stop this shooting, but he has now started a GoFundMe account to help the victims of the Waffle House shooting, the victims and their families, to pay for medical bills, funeral costs, that kind of thing. So really stand up guy, somebody that I think that a lot of us can look up to and admire, that he saw the opportunity, he saw the danger that he was in as a, he saw that as something that it was his responsibility to take control of the situation and his own life. And he was able to wrestle the gun away from the guy, throw it over the counter and chase him outside. And then of course, police were able to pick him up a couple days later. But, you know, kudos to this guy, and then going the extra mile and saying, even though I've done this, I'm still not done. These people still need help. And so starting a GoFundMe account to help the victims, help the people involved in this. So really, really great guy. I can't, you know, say enough good about him. Somebody that I really admire. And so even in this, the wake of this horrible tragedy, we can look at somebody like James Shaw Jr. who refuses to be a victim, who chooses to instead be a conqueror, who instead chooses to take responsibility and take the initiative, not only during but also after the shooting, and say, this is really what the American spirit is about. This is the kind of people that we should be in our lives. 860-1440. We'll be right back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Philippians 3:20. For our citizenship is in heaven, from which also we eagerly wait for a Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ.
Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440, those are the numbers if you'd like to get in touch with me that way. You're also welcome to tweet me at Tactics Radio. That is always an option if you want to get in on the show. Now, getting back to what we were talking about with the Waffle House shooting, of course, and I know that everybody's expecting this, it's not going to surprise anybody, but of course, just like every other shooting, the left, within literally hours of this taking place, before the bodies were even cold and the crime scene was cleaned up, they were already calling for new gun control, as they always do. But there's something to keep in mind, and we've already covered really why this is the case, but no new gun control law could have possibly stopped this person. Because his guns were already confiscated, he got them back illegally, which could not have been prevented by any law that I'm aware of. He did. We don't know if his guns were purchased legally or illegally initially, but we know for a fact that he had them confiscated and was not given permission to have them back, and yet got them back anyway. We're not sure exactly how that took place yet. But because of that, there is no new gun control law that would have prevented what happened by this guy. And not only was he insane, but he was also a felon. So if he had tried to purchase a new gun or tried to get a gun through any legal channels, he would have been stopped. Now, the insanity part, we can, you know, question that because, of course, even though he was clearly mentally disturbed, there's questionable whether or not legal ramifications would have played into that. Now, this is someone that really should have been forcibly committed, and being forcibly committed would have automatically restricted him from having guns according to the current laws that are already on the books. But he's also a felon, which means he could not legally obtain firearms in the time period before that took place and already had his firearms taken away, which means no amount of gun control. You could literally make all guns illegal tomorrow, and that law, had it been enacted a couple months ago, for example, would not have stopped this guy from shooting this Waffle House. It would not have taken place. Because no laws can stop criminals from doing illegal things. That's the thing about laws. Criminals tend to ignore them. That's what makes them criminals. In this guy's case, he had to break the law to get his firearms. No matter how you look at it. Now, he may have initially purchased them legally. We don't know that yet. But even if he purchased them legally initially, they were taken away from him, and it was not lawful for him to be in possession of them anymore, and yet he was still in possession of them, which means he had to break the law to get his guns. And we see this over and over and over again. In the Sutherland Springs and Parkland shooting, for example, technically the guns were obtained without breaking any laws in the sense that the background check system did not catch them. However, the issue in both cases was a failure on law enforcement. The Air Force did not report to the background system, to the system that the FBI runs, that the Sutherland Springs shooter had a history of domestic violence, which should have disqualified him from purchasing his firearms. And in the case of Parkland shooting, there were multiple, and we've had attorneys from Florida confirm this, there were multiple occasions of police reports that should have marked him as a felon that he was not prosecuted for. And had law enforcement done their job in that situation, he too would have not been able to legally obtain his firearms. And so in these cases, this was a failing on the part of law enforcement officials. It appears in this case that is not what happened. It looks like law enforcement was doing their job, at least at every stage of this that we know of right now. However, this was not really so much a failing on law enforcement and as it was in those shootings, as it was a failing of our laws on the mentally insane, because it is really, really difficult to get someone forcibly committed. And I understand the logic behind that, being very libertarian myself. I understand that you don't want people just being committed for any old thing. I get that. I'm 100% supportive of that. However, with somebody like this, with multiple instances that show clear issues with this guy where his own parents were reporting him for his behavior, that seems to me like that is clearly somebody that should be deemed legally mentally incapable of possessing a firearm. Because like other conservatives, like the NRA, like these other gun rights groups, I too want guns out of the hands of bad guys. Because when guns do find their way into the hands of bad guys, gun crime takes place. I'm all for lawful, law-abiding citizens having their right to keep and bear arms. But if you break the law or have shown yourself completely incapable of handling the responsibility of firearm ownership, that is when a change needs to take place. That is when we can say, even though there needs to be a high bar to clear, and I agree with that, that we can look at that person and say, you're not somebody that needs to be in possession of these things. The same way that we would look at someone, even though it's not a right, and that's why I think the bar should be higher for gun ownership, we could look at something like being able to drive a car. There should be barriers to that if someone is incapable of handling that responsibility. But of course, as predictable as it always is, the left has already jumped on the gun control debate and tried to use this as an excuse to take guns not out of the hands of bad guys like this person, but used it to push policies that would remove guns from the hands of law-abiding citizens. David Hogg and Emma Gonzalez, for example, two of the Parkland students, they tweeted out about this guy who stopped the shooter and mentioned that he was unarmed, which is true. Now, this is a rare exception to the rule. James Shaw Jr. was unarmed at the time of this, which I think shows an incredible amount of courage on his part to be able to stop the guy. But in both of the cases, both Hogg and Emma Gonzalez were saying, well, I guess this destroys the narrative that only a good guy with a gun can stop a bad guy with a gun. Well, I mean, there are instances of a good person with a gun stopping a bad guy with a gun in the past. This is one of those times. It is incredibly rare that it happens. And here's another thing, too. This argument hinges on two points. First of all, you were essentially making the case, and this is the case that Gonzalez made in her tweet, that teachers and school resource officers don't need firearms on them to stop shootings. Well, theoretically, maybe, but are you trying to make the case that James Shaw Jr. with a gun would have been less effective than him without a gun? Because let's keep in mind, if we're breaking down the narrative that he himself presented, he had to wait for the guy to either unload or the firearm to jam. He says he doesn't know which happened. But either way, there was a pause in the shooting and he took advantage of it. And then, of course, he shot him in the elbow, but he was able to take the shooter down. If he had a firearm on him and could return fire, normally what happens in those situations, the second that a shooter finds out that there is somebody else on the premises with a gun, not every time, but many times when that happens, they start fleeing. That's typically what happens. Either they hunker down and try to exchange gunfire, or they wind up fleeing. Most of the times, they wind up fleeing for their lives. And considering that this is a person that didn't go out in a blaze of glory, that didn't try to fight police officers, that wound up in custody, that is a good indication that this probably more than likely would have been a person that would have fled had he even heard gunfire, not even necessarily having to be shot by somebody. So you have to make the case for that argument to work, that somebody, a good guy with a gun, would have made either the situation worse or not made a difference. I have a hard time believing that having somebody there with a gun would not have been able to stop the shooter faster, because this guy had to wait for there to be a pause in the shooting to go after him and tackle him. And even despite that, still got grazed. Had he not waited for that, the guy might not have been grazed at all. Had that happened, he could have just reached out, shot, the guy's gone. You know, the guy either dies or he's down, he's out of commission. It only would have taken a couple of well-placed shots to take care of that. And then the shooting would have been stopped much earlier. He wouldn't have had to wait for a pause in the shooting. He could have returned fire immediately, as long as he had found cover. So the presence of a gun could have quite possibly, I think very likely, especially in the hands of James Shaw Jr., who took on the mentality that he was going to do something, he was going to preserve his own life and take responsibility for that. You can't really make the case that having a gun there would not have made the shooting less deadly, as it often does. And we see examples of that in the news all the time. According to the CDC, anywhere between 500,000 to 3 million cases of defensive use of firearms every single year. We saw that in a school shooting where the student resource officer happened to be there, and because he was there and because he was able to respond quickly, there was only one death. It didn't even classify as a mass shooting because there was only one person that died. And so the idea that this completely debunks the idea of a good guy with a gun stopping a bad guy with a gun, this is a rare exception to the rule. The rule is that usually if a gun is present, then lives are saved. And there's no telling how many lives are saved. Because keep in mind, that's 500,000 to 3 million, according to the CDC, incidents. That's not lives saved. If each one just saved two lives, well, then that doubles the number right there. That would be the potential of 6 million lives saved a year because of defensive use of firearms. And so that argument completely falls apart when held up to even the slightest amount of scrutiny. And here's another thing, too. If they really believe this, if they really believe that you're, whether you have a gun or not, you're just as equipped to take down a shooter. You can take down a shooter with or without a gun, and it's just fine. Why didn't they stop Parkland then? If David Hogg and Emma Gonzalez really believe that somebody without a gun is just as equipped to stop somebody as somebody with a gun, they were unarmed. They were there in Parkland when the school shooting was taking place. David Hogg has video of him in a closet during the Parkland shooting. So if they really believe this, if they're really saying, you don't need a gun to stop a bad guy, why didn't they do it? Why didn't they do it? Now, again, I'm not trying to rake these kids over the coals. That's an incredibly difficult situation to be in. And you never know how you're going to react to something like that until your life is being threatened like theirs were. All I'm saying is, if they're going to beat this drum, if they're going to say, well, this proves that you don't need a gun to stop a shooter, well, then why didn't they stop the shooter? Why didn't they stop the shooting in Parkland? Why didn't they save several lives? The truth is, when faced with the reality of their own mortality, when faced with a situation like this, even they understood, whether they would ever admit to it or not, that because they were unarmed, they were not well equipped to take on the shooter, and that they thought that it was a safer bet for them to stay away from the guy rather than try to fight back. And so, frankly, the fact that of them just being them kind of defeats any credibility that they have in making this case. All right, we'll talk about a couple more tweets by them and other arguments that the left is making in just a second when we come back. 860-1440.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
Galatians 5:1. It was for freedom that Christ set us free. Therefore, keep standing firm and do not be subject again to a yoke of slavery.
Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440, those are the numbers if you want to get in touch with me. And you can also tweet me at Tactics Radio if you want to get into the show that way as well. We offer both of those avenues if you want to. By the way, speaking of Twitter, we are going to get into a couple of the tweets that the Parkland students have put out there. Because these are typically, and the reason I do this is not because I think that their tweets in and of themselves are necessarily all that significant, more so that these are the arguments that you're going to be hearing from people on the left in the coming days about whether or not this Waffle House shooting should be used as a bludgeon or as a weapon to try to push the agenda of gun control. So there's a couple things that I wanted to point out. Gonzalez, in case you're wondering who Gonzalez is, Emma Gonzalez, she's the little girl that spoke at the March for Our Lives. She's the one that looks like Negasonic Teenage Warhead from Deadpool. So if you've ever seen that movie, which by the way, Deadpool 2, the trailer is out now. It looks really funny. Unfortunately, I will not be seeing it in theaters. It's a little too rough for me. I will be waiting to see Deadpool 2 when it comes out, and I can filter out the bad words, which I did with the original Deadpool. I just had to censor a lot of the content. I hope that VidAngel is back up and running by the time that Deadpool 2 comes out, and I can rent that and just watch it with all the filters on. But nonetheless, take that aside for just a moment. She looks like Negasonic Teenage Warhead, if you're confused about which one that is. But anyway, she tweets out the other day, and this was just hours after the shooting. I mean, like, I think that this one was actually Sunday morning, not long after she woke up. So she goes on a tweet tirade about this. And one of the ones that she brought up, quote, removing the assault and semi-automatic weapons from our civilian society, instituting thorough background checks and mandatory waiting periods, and raising the buying age and banning the production of high-capacity magazines are ways to stop shootings in America. Okay, so there's a couple things here, and we'll just go through them very quickly because I've already gone through these on the show before. If you want more detail, you can go back to my podcast on SoundCloud and on tacticsradio.com to look up all these arguments that I've made before. We're just going to kind of hit them very quickly without a lot of explanation. since we've kind of already gone through this before. Okay, thorough background checks and mandatory waiting periods. Background checks have been implemented. We already have them. I have no problem with fixing some of the holes in the system if there are some. But as far as implementing more thorough background checks, I don't know how much more thorough you can get. If you're a felon, you're already barred from getting a firearm. That's the way that it already is in America. With waiting periods have never shown to have any impact on gun crime whatsoever. If you want to commit a crime, you usually don't purchase your gun legally. And even if you do, if you're intent on doing that, you're going to do it regardless of when you get your gun. So that hasn't shown to be anything except for a pain in the butt for lawful gun owners. Increasing the buying age, that, again, has not shown any decrease in crime whatsoever with states that have implemented it. When it comes to the handguns, handguns are still the most common gun used in any kind of gun crime, despite the fact that you have to be 21 to purchase one. The vast majority of mass shooters are not under the age of 21 anyway. Like this guy in the Waffle House shooting, they're usually much older than the age of 21. The average age of a mass shooter is, I believe, 34. Last time I checked, it's either 34 or 39. But anyway, so that is, none of those arguments make any sense. And she's saying that that is the way to stop shootings in America. Also brings about the production and sale of high-capacity magazines. Well, there are states like California that have already done that, and New York, and we still have mass shootings in New York. Look at San Bernardino. So the idea that just getting rid of high-capacity magazines takes away and means that it is impossible for people to commit mass shootings, that's simply not the case. And guess what? In San Bernardino, they had high-capacity magazines. So there you go. Now, looking back at this and trying to understand exactly what is going on here, none of these things that she is promoting have shown any correlation between actually stopping mass shootings. But the most important thing was what she said first, is that we should remove assault and semi-automatic weapons. Now, she probably doesn't realize this because she's shown an astounding lack of knowledge when it comes to guns on this subject. However, I don't think she realizes that when you say ban semi-automatic weapons, that's basically all the weapons. That's most of the firearms in this country. You have a handful of exceptions. There are some bolt-action rifles that are still made. There's a couple of lever-action rifles that are still made. I actually have a lever-action rifle at my house. But the point is, the vast, vast majority of weapons, except for pump-action shotguns and a couple of rifles, are all semi-automatic. And you also have double-action revolvers, which, even though they're technically not semi-automatic because you still have the hammer there, they function exactly semi-automatic because it's one trigger squeeze, one round comes out of the chamber. So it's basically functions as a semi-automatic. So if you want to remove semi-automatic weapons, that basically means removing all weapons. But don't worry, nobody's coming after your guns. Just all the ones that have been produced since the 1900s. I mean, seriously, with the exception, like I said, of a bolt action and a lever action, which are not real common anymore, just about every weapon that you're going to buy is going to be a semi-automatic weapon. Handguns, long guns, regardless. The only big exception that I can think of is shotguns, and even some of them are semi-automatic. Pump action shotguns are still pretty popular, but you do have semi-automatic shotguns as well. So the idea that we're not coming after your guns, don't worry, nobody's coming after your guns. Well, except all of the guns. Except all of them, except for a handful. I don't know exactly how many, because they don't keep stats on this kind of stuff, of the guns in America are semi-automatics, but I would be willing to guess that it's got to be north of 80% of the firearms sold in the past 20 years are semi-automatics, because virtually all your handguns except for revolvers are. And even the double-action revolvers, like I said, function exactly like a semi-auto. But don't worry, nobody's coming after your guns. See, it's stuff like this that lets you know that what their agenda really is. Finally, the mask comes off. They really are going after virtually all of your guns. And another thing that she tweeted out the other day, the FBI defines mass shootings as 4 people killed, not including the shooter. Mass shootings occur in churches, schools, concerts, Waffle Houses, and just about anywhere, except in other countries. Now, the first half of her statement is correct. A mass shooting is defined as when four people or more are killed, not including the shooter. That's the only ounce of truth to this. Because she says mass shootings occur everywhere except in other countries. Let's look at the top six mass shootings of all time. So the maximum amount of casualties by casualty, the largest mass shootings that have ever occurred, 2017, a mosque in Egypt is attacked, resulting in over 305 deaths. 2015, a Kenyan college is attacked, resulting in 148 deaths. Number three, 2014, a Pakistan school is massacred, 141 deaths. Number four, 2015, the Paris attack. You remember the Paris attack that happened a couple years ago. 130 deaths. 2011, an attack in Norway results in 67 deaths. In 2013, a Kenyan shopping mall is attacked, resulting in 67 deaths. So you have to get to number seven to even get to America, which would have been the Las Vegas shooting at that concert. So they occur everywhere except in other countries. Well, unless you're counting all the mass shootings that happen in other countries. Not an ounce of truth to this whatsoever. And by the way, do you notice a pattern with these countries that I just listed off? Do you notice some commonality between all of them? Every single one of them, much stricter gun control laws than here in America. Much stricter. And they have far less guns per capita than America does. Far less. Even if you adjust for population, way less guns than America. And yet, despite this, they still have larger mass shootings than we do. So the idea that stricter gun control is going to stop mass shootings or make mass shootings less deadly, there is a mountain of evidence that suggests that there is no truth to that whatsoever. But of course, I say all the time that facts don't care about their feelings. I guess Emma Gonzalez's feelings don't care about the facts, as evidenced by the arguments that she makes. Somehow in each of these situations, bad guys still got guns. Even though it was illegal for them to have guns, even though they have really strict gun control, the bad guys still got guns. It's almost like the bad guys don't care that it's illegal for them to have guns. All these countries have stricter gun control than Gonzalez is even proposing. Even what she was talking about with raising the mandatory age, with banning semi-automatics and automatics, in each one of these situations, if you're looking at the whole of what she's talking about, they have stricter gun control even than Emma Gonzalez is proposing. And they still had larger mass shootings than the United States of America. So I'm sorry if I'm not taking your argument seriously, because they are not based in truth. And that's pretty common when we're talking about extremists on the left that just want to grab guns, as she has proven that she does. All right, Chaplin's report is up next.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Galatians 5, 13 and 14. For you were called to freedom, brethren. Only do not turn your freedom into an opportunity for the flesh, but through love serve one another. For the whole law is fulfilled in one word, in the statement, you shall love your neighbor as yourself.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440, those are the numbers if you want to call in. We do have the Chaplain's Report on now. Now, to understand exactly what's going on in this, you need to know that Jeremiah has been preaching the truth, and the truth was very unpopular at the time. And because he was talking about God's Word, because he was conveying the messages that God was sending him, he became very unpopular because what he was talking about is that, Judah, you are doing things wrong, and if you do not repent, if you do not change your evil ways, what is going to happen is Babylon is going to take over and you're going to be taken away into captivity. People did not like that message. People didn't like being told that they were wrong. And because of that, there were a lot of people that did not like Jeremiah at the time that he was prophesying. And there was an official of the temple named Pashur, who was a very powerful priest, who, because of this and because he didn't like what Jeremiah was saying, put him in stocks. He actually put him under imprisonment. If you've ever seen stocks, it's that thing that you always see where they've got their hands and their head in a basically locked in a block of wood. So he puts Jeremiah in stocks, imprisons him, and Jeremiah responds by telling Pashur this in Jeremiah 20, 5 through 6. This is a message that Jeremiah is conveying from the Lord. I will also give over the wealth of this city and all the produce and all of its costly things, even all the treasures of the kings of Judah, I will give over to the hand of their enemies, and they will plunder them and take them away and bring them to Babylon. And you, Pashur, all who live in your house will go into captivity, and you will enter Babylon, and there you will die, and there you will be buried, you and all your friends to whom you have falsely prophesied. Pretty powerful stuff coming directly from the Lord. Why was God so angry at the priest Pashur? Because not only did Pashur lie, he lied in God's name. That's what got God angry. That it's not only that you're telling lies, that you're saying these things are going to take place, that you're saying that Babylon's not going to take Judah into captivity, but because you're saying them, because you're saying this is the message I'm receiving from God, because you're misrepresenting what God is actually saying, that's what got God angry. That's what upset him. That's what made him furious, and that's the reason that he offered such a harsh punishment to Pashur on this side of eternity. Because it's bad to lie, but it's really bad to lie in God's name and pretend that you are doing so on his behalf. So why was God so angry with Judah? Because he's obviously mad at Pashur, but he's also mad at Judah, and we can tell that from this passage. The reason that God was mad with Judah is that he gave them good prophets, but they chose the false prophets because they liked the message better. The false prophets, like Pashur, were tickling their ears. They were saying things that Judah liked, and not because they wanted to or because they believed it was true, but because they wanted it to be true, they chose to listen to the prophets that were saying nice things about them. They didn't like being told that they were wrong. They didn't like the message that God was actually sending through Jeremiah, and that's why God got mad at Judah. God will punish liars, but he will also punish those who love lies more than truth, that prefer an easy message to the one that he gives. Stay the course, friends.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.